So, may we start?
1, 2, 3, 4! So may we start? It's time to start. My time to start.
What's up, everybody? You're listening to the Third Act Podcast, episode number 211. I'm your host, Christian Estabrook, and with me, as always, is Jericho Serrona.
Where's all my soul, sisters? Let me feel your flow, sisters.
Hey, sister, go, sister, soul, sister, flow, sister.
Excellent, excellent work, my friend. Listeners, we want to remind you that all of us here at the Third Act Podcast, we watch lots of films, we have lots of opinions on those films, and we're just pretentious enough to think that you care. Yes, Jericho announced it. He stole my thunder. This episode is called Soul Sisters, because we're talking about two South Korean films that are led by women protagonists, both from or in Seoul or going to Seoul. Soul Sisters, that's what we're doing, Jericho.
It is the Soul Sisters episode, Christian. I mean, we've got to hand it to you that you came up with this title, and because we were trying to find a suitable connection or comparison or a pairing film with a new release, Return to Seoul. And I did find that film, but you found the title.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy with Soul Sisters. I hope that's not like crass in any way. It seems like a fun little cheeky title, and I do like the choice you went, because we could have called this episode "Hey Soul Sister," but I think it's better if we don't invoke Train if we can avoid it.
I didn't even know that until like I looked up. I was trying to find that song, and I couldn't remember. I knew it was from Moulin Rouge, but Lady Marmalade, I guess, is the name of the song.
Right.
I haven't heard that forever, but I was trying to find the song on Google, and that's the first thing that came up. "Hey Soul Sister" by Train, and I was tempted. I don't remember that song, but I was definitely tempted to play it just to piss everybody off. But I think it would have been a bridge too far.
I think we went the right route. I think we both made the right decision when it comes to our soul puns. So nice work to start things off. Obviously, we got some movies to talk about. We got a new release. We got a pairing film. But Jericho, I feel like we do need to let people know. If anyone's listening to every episode, I don't know. We've been recording a lot. Myra's probably listened to every episode. Not our moms, even though we did a mom episode. I don't know if anyone's listening to all the episodes we're doing. We might not even have the minister on board for this many episodes. But for anyone who is listening as these episodes come out, we did tacitly promise an Air Jer episode today, but that's not what we're doing.
No, this is mostly contingent on one, Armando Rivera's availability, because we can't really do this episode without him. It's kind of like a pact we made months ago now. So I'm not going to, you know, I don't want to, you know, I'm trying to manifest this or whatever, but we keep talking about it and it keeps being pushed back. So maybe we just leave it there and we don't even promise the episode, and then it's just going to drop in the feed one day, and listener, you're going to be really excited. Because Air Jer is very near and dear to my heart personally, and there's a connection with Armando through our past.
Yeah,
it's a whole thing, and we are talking about movies as well, but I think it's more of a celebration of youth, because I'm no longer Air Jer. I cannot jump. I can barely run anymore. So this is maybe I'm going to be the sad, overweight, middle-aged Matt Damon character at the end of the movie Air. That's going to be my current state, rather than the spry, floating through the air kid I was as a teenager when I used to play pickup games.
Yeah. Well, and it sounds like you have seen Air. Mm-hmm. What is it called? Air, the
a story of greatness.
A story of greatness. So stupid. That's for folks who haven't pulled this up on Prime Video. That's what it's listed as the title of the film, which is very silly, very silly. But hopefully we can talk about Air soon. Jericho, I would like to do a quick check-in, if you'll indulge me. I want to do a Letterboxd check-in just because I've been, you know, logging all my movies, of course, and just wanted to do a quick pulse. I mean, that's not a good title. A Letterboxd look, Letterboxd look-see. Can we do a Letterboxd look-see real quick?
Okay, we'll work on that, but
title unconfirmed. I just want to give you an update here, if you don't mind, if we can take a look at the numbers. I don't know exactly where I am throughout each year, but I feel like this is a little bit of an outlier. I've watched more new to me films so far in 2023 than all of the rewatches I've done and new releases I've watched combined. I've done 40 rewatches this year. I've done 31 new releases, 76 new to me so far here in mid-May. Seems pretty okay. Good, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's a good stat. What does that mean?
It means I'm watching a lot of old movies. I just wanted to, I don't know. Can I share? Can I tell you some of the best stuff I've watched this year? It just feels like it's shaping up.
If it's not apparent. Christian loves this Letterboxd. He is so connected to this thing. It's pride and joy for him. So yes, continue. New to me films.
I've watched a little film you may have heard of called Fritz Lang's M. Pretty great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Pretty much a locked in masterpiece. I watched Koyaanisqatsi for the first time. Also probably a masterpiece. I watched Singing in the Rain, The French Connection, Gaslight, The Sting, and The Heat of the Night. These are all first-time watches from Grave of the Fireflies. It's been a great year so far, Jericho. That's what I'm trying to say.
Is there any rhyme to this? Like, are you just kind of cherry-picking things that are on your queue of shame? Or it seems like a wide variety of things.
Yeah, well, I get inspiration to watch old movies from all sorts of different things. I think I was reading a book that was really highlighting M, so I was like, okay, I'm going to finally check this off the list. And there's some other ones I heard mentioned on a podcast. I'm like, okay, I'm going to do this. And then some other ones, I don't even know. Like, I watched Singing in the Rain, and I'd been mocked many times by my sister and her boyfriend. They had been saying for a couple of years now that that's the most famous movie that I'd never seen. And they were just like aghast that I'd never seen Singing in the Rain. So one night we're just like, all right, tonight's the night. Let's watch Singing in the Rain. Let's do it. I also, my sister's boyfriend gets on random kicks too. So he watched all of the Oscar best pictures this year. So I joined him for some of those. That's why I watched The Sting, In the Heat of the Night, French Connection. Those were opportunities for me to check some of those off the list as well. And you know, I like doing filmographies. I finished off the Kathryn Bigelow filmography, and four capital G great movies from her filmography I'd never seen before. I don't know if you remember the 80s to 90s run from Kathryn Bigelow, but we have Near Dark, Blue Steel, Point Break, Strange Days, all bangers, bangers, all bangers, all the way down.
Yeah. The only one of those I have not seen is Blue Steel, but the other ones I've seen. And Near Dark is good. That's Paxton, right? Mugging up
yes.
a storm in that one.
Being hot as hell, too.
Yeah. Interestingly, and oddly, no mention of The Scout or With Honors in your rundown there.
I realized I hadn't put star ratings on those ones yet. And I'm like, oh, boy, I got to give some only a couple of stars to some Brendan Fraser movies at some point.
Yeah,
there's also some stuff we've done on the podcast just recently. Pierrot Le Fou, Alphaville, those are also highlights of the year far. But obviously, we just talked about those. So I don't know. I just wanted to give you a quick update, Jared, that it's a great year in film. And you're a part of a lot of it. And I'm happy to be on this journey with you, my friend.
Oh, yeah. And then there's the the Czech new wave stuff too.
Oh yeah.
Something Absolutely. Different. Yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, Flowers of St. Francis. Did you already mention that one? Flowers of St. Francis.
I don't know if I mentioned that. Yeah.
That's a huge, huge one too. Yeah. So it's looking good. I'm looking at, I'm on my Letterboxd and I've got, I mean, I haven't seen as much as you, but 29 new to me films, but just real quick. I mean, I have some of these, you know, huge titles like you, but also a lot of random stuff. I've watched Empire Falls, which is a miniseries with Ed Harris, because I read the book Delirious with Michael Pitt and Steve Buscemi, An Ideal Husband, and
that rom-com movie.
Yeah, with, I mean, the cast is stacked. It's got Cate Blanchett, Julianne Moore, and Minnie Driver.
Wow.
Who's the
husband though? Who's the ideal
Rupert
husband?
Everett.
Oh my gosh! Remember Rupert Everett?
Yeah, he was a big deal. And this
from was My Best Friend's Wedding, right?
Yeah, '90s movie. Anyways, and then I also watched Meteor Man for the first time.
Holy shit!
Have you seen that?
I don't know if I've seen all of it. I remember it being on TV as
a
kid.
It's hard to find, but it's Robert Townsend that directed it and stars in it. Who was also kind of a big deal back then, but not a great movie, but really entertaining, kind of interesting from the standpoint of like a black superhero movie of that era, the early 90s. And Don Cheadle's in it, young Don Cheadle, as like a kind of like a gun wielding baddie with like yellow hair. So kind of like reminded me a bit of Demolition Man. Wesley Snipes kind of look.
Sure.
Anyways, we're off tangent here.
Well, last one I'll name check. You brought up Robert Townsend. I also watched Hollywood Shuffle for the first time this year.
Oh yeah, great movie.
That movie rules.
Really funny.
Rules. Yeah. Oh yeah. Really funny. Really biting. Great starring project for him as well. All right, that's our Letterboxd look-see. Thanks for indulging me there. But we got to travel across the pond. We're going to go to South Korea. We're going to talk about two films that I think pair pretty well together. There's some different tones we're going to get into with the two of these films. But overall, I think we did a good job finding a couple to talk about here. The new release is called Return to Seoul. And then we're going to pair that with the 2017 film called Micro Habitat. That's the English title, at least. So digging in, Return to Seoul is directed by Davey Chow. It stars Park Ji-min, Oh Kwon-rok, and Guka Han. The synopsis, a 25-year-old French woman returns to Korea, the country she was born in, before being adopted by a French couple for the very first time. She decides to track down her biological parents, but her journey takes a surprising turn. So this is one that's been on my radar for a while. Jericho, I think I've been throwing this your way a couple of times, trying to figure out if this is one that we should cover. I believe I'm not familiar with this director. I don't know these other ones. Yeah, I think there's a couple other features. Had you been familiar with Davey Chow before checking out Return to Seoul at all?
I don't think so. What has he done?
The other features are called Diamond Island and Golden Slumbers, both from the 2010s.
Nope. So, yeah, first time for me.
Not familiar with either of those. This one's been on my radar for a while. It played a bunch of festivals last year. I think it may have got like a foreign language Oscar like buzz or whatever, things like that. I saw it on a bunch of top 10 lists, not a bunch, but I saw it on some top 10 lists last year from different critics and things like that, even though it didn't get its official American release until this year. So it's been a few months that I've been kind of tracking this one, wanting to check it out, and I convinced Jericho to take the plunge. Let's get into it, Jericho. What do you think of Return to Seoul?
Well, this is a really interesting film, Christian. In many ways, it reminded me of Joachim Trier's The Worst Person in the World. Did you ever see that?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Okay. I might have been the only person in the world that was kind of mixed on that. I think everyone loved it. But in the sense that this movie reminded me of that, in how the lead female character is restless, adventurous, kind of prone to experiencing life just in the moment rather than following a sort of preset path. The difference here, though, is that the character of Freddie, who's played by Park Ji-min, is on a journey of self-discovery that involves cultural identity. So Freddie was raised in France by adoptive parents and then returns to Seoul for the first time since she was a baby, I believe. So she identifies almost solely as French, which she even mentions, I think, like in the opening scene. And yet there's this void that's left by the absence of her biological Korean parents, which creates this identity confusion that the film uses to focus on Freddie's struggle to understand and embody who she wants to be in life. And I think the best thing about this movie, which I did like a good deal, is how complicated Freddie is as a protagonist. She's seemingly directionless, but she still feels like she's in control. She breaks down people's defense mechanisms right away in an opening scene at a diner where she somehow gets all these strangers from separate tables to sit together. She's the type of person who doesn't really think about the consequences of her actions. She's operating in the moment. She just feels whatever the emotion of a current moment is, even if she often keeps her emotions clustered inside. She always kind of has this semi-permanent frown on her face. And the director here, Davey Chow, favors close-ups a lot here, allowing his camera to focus almost exclusively on Freddie's face. And what's interesting is that the film jumps through four different sections. We always eventually return to Freddie's face, even when her appearance, like physical appearance or clothing, kind of the way she carries herself, changes and mutates over the years. And Freddie's the type of person, kind of like Greta Gerwig in Mistress America, that draws other people into her orbit. People are, they want to sort of like find out what she's about. They want to be around her because she's so impulsive and exciting. But like Gerwig's character in that Noah Baumbach movie, after a certain period of time, the downsides in terms of holding on to meaningful relationships and friendships starts to show. We see this trend after Freddie befriends the clerk at her hostel, but who kind of like becomes her tour guide and her translator in Korea. And at first, we have this blossoming friendship. It seems genuine, but we know because of how Freddie is that this ultimately will be something that will fall away. Freddie is life of the party. She likes to stir up shit. It goes against Korean social norms. And she investigates her birth parents. We have a whole kind of awkward sequence where she meets her biological father and his new family. And the father's guilt and his heavy drinking kind of becomes suffocating to her. Freddie doesn't appear to care much about having a relationship with her biological parents. So why does she go on this search? And again, this is what I liked about this film and this character. She's contradictory. As the film jumps through time, we see her go from dancing wildly in hipster bars to working as a cross-cultural consultant with like slicked back hair. And I was always fascinated by Freddie. You never know quite what she's thinking or what she might say or what she might do as the film moves around in time. And I think this is where Park Ji-min's performance comes into play. This performance has to work if the film is going to work at all. And being a first-time actor, I guess she's a visual artist, so this is her first film role. Her lack of vanity. Her naturalism means we believe Freddie is a real person. At least I did. I bought this character completely. And Park's ability to convey this inner pain, this isolation, despite what might be happening on the surface, is pretty remarkable, I think. And this is ultimately a film that seems to float away from my memory. It's not really lingering. I know we say that a lot on this podcast. This one kind of floats away from me. But the character of Freddie is lingering, is sticking with me. The movie ends on a quiet, lonely, ambiguous note, something that I admire. And yet it kind of fades away, too, which makes me wonder, will Freddie, this character, fade away? Is she content? Is she happy? Why is she alone? What does playing this piano in the final moments mean to her? I guess this is a strength of the film, but I can't help but want to know more. I'm hoping for the best for Freddie. I'm sort of like willing a life of contentment for her, but the film doesn't really give you that. And that's normally, and it's something I admire in this case, and it's normally something I favor over sort of being wrapped up or giving us more. But in this specific case, I wanted a little bit more. But it's still a pretty strong film, and I think it's, is really that character and that performance that I'm hanging on to above anything else that happens here, because it's not really plot oriented. It's not really, it doesn't give you a lot of catharsis or answers. Similarly, like the film we talked about a little while ago, 1001, it kind of has that similar withholding. But I think that one maybe has a little bit more of an emotional punch or a catharsis by the end. As evidenced by Christian's take, by your take, Christian, where you were really moved. And maybe this film moved you in a similar way. There are some scenes that are poignant and powerful, but overall it's kind of this mystery and the ambiguity around this character and the contradictions that she has that makes me lean forward and more interested than I would normally be. So, maybe it doesn't sound like a huge ring endorsement, but I did like this film quite a bit. But I think really it's just that character for me and that performance that really just is sticking with me, even if the film kind of like is kind of hazy. Maybe I need to watch it again on a rewatch. I'll get more of the nuances. But where are you at on this one, Christian? Is Freddie a soul sister? Is she...
She is certainly a soul sister. That's for certain. No bones about that. Yeah, I agree with a lot of what you said. I think this movie really hangs on the performance by Park Ji-min. I mean, the movie has to kind of rely on her performance in order for this to work at all. But it really, I mean, I don't know anything about the production of this. I mean, she seems like kind of a muse for David Chow, or there was some kind of collaboration. There's just so much use of her look and her sometimes kind of vacant facial expressions, and sometimes where she seems to be a bit more performative and like trying to liven up parties, like you said. But just some of the subtle and then like more pronounced changes to her face and to her look as we jump through these different time periods, it really seems like that was a big inspiration into how this story would unfold. Again, that's all speculation. I have no knowledge at all of the production of this movie, but it seems like from the final product here that was a big aspect of what the story would be. I feel like we're being drawn towards some of our new release movies, a lot of somewhat familiar stories that are told in not entirely obvious ways. You know, we've talked about, you know, end of life relationships and One Fine Morning. We've talked about troubling, like coming of age in difficult circumstances in 1001, and like an adoptee story, like trying to find their place, their true family, kind of wrestling with identity. All of these feel like, one, I think both familiar topics in real life and familiar topics in film. And Return to Soul is something where I feel like it avoids a lot of the obvious paths to go down. I mean, I think you get through the performance a lot of the emotional journey that Freddie goes through, but there's a lot that's not spoken very loudly or clearly in dialogue or kind of like really bald-faced scenes that kind of lay all the cards out on the table. You really just rely on her performance to let you know what she's thinking and feeling through most of this journey. But you get the impression that her life, her adoption, how she's been raised and grown up has led to some confusion as far as who she is, where she belongs. I think most adoptees like have these questions about who are their parents, why was I not wanted, what was it in their situation that made them not want to keep me. There's this sense of is there a problem, is there something inferior about me, like what does this mean in order for this to happen? And that's before taking into consideration entire other cultures, which we have in Return to Seoul. And maybe just from kind of my own siloed lived experience and you know, wanting to expose myself to new stories and new experiences, I really like this just from the example of having a South Korean child adopted by French parents. I feel like I'm much more accustomed to this type of conversation in America and am more familiar with the typical story or the typical kind of complaints or pain points of American families or individuals or couples adopting children from other countries and what that experience is like. So removing America from the picture entirely, and this was also something that kind of drew me into the story of like, what does this mean? Is this very similar to other stories I'm familiar with, or is the cultural context here something completely different? And this is like complete uncharted territory for the types of stories that I've come across. So that was something that really drew me in as well. But you have the way Freddie kind of reacts to certain situations. It seems clear that she yearns for some kind of connection, for a relationship, for a place and identity. But when she does get close, she can also like push people away or resist to some degree. She has some somewhat awkward, like kind of romantic encounters while in Seoul. We have the situation with her father that you kind of touched on as well, where he is more receptive. He wants her to be around. He invites her to stay close and near, which seemingly that's what Freddie wants on the surface, or would probably be something if she were honest, she would say that she wants. But then something about living through that is uncomfortable or kind of pushes her away, and she resists that, possibly because of how pronounced his regret is. And he talks about, you know, what he would have wanted to do differently and offers explanations, things like that. And it's not entirely clear. Is it just too painful, or is it too much? Is it like too much all at once? Like Freddie has had these desires, wants to have these answers, wants to have these conversations. But then once it becomes real, it's a bit too overwhelming in some case. Like these are all the types of things that she's dealing with. And then, I mean, how it unfolds with her and her mother, it seems just through context of how she reacts to certain things without ever having to spell it all out in a big dramatic scene, it seems like that's most important to her. What was that relationship? Who is this person? Why was there this disconnect? Why does she have more trouble connecting with her at this point? That's all fascinating. And there's some kind of turns that takes as the movie jumps forward in time that I found really satisfying from a narrative perspective as well. There's also really graceful moments when Freddie interacts with her adopted parents. Like I thought there was a really touching scene where she's talking with her adopted mom while she's already in Seoul, and Freddie's trying to hide why she's there, hide the purpose of her trip, and her adopted mom kind of sees through that immediately. I mean, shout out to moms again, right? From our from our Mother Boy episode. Like, it just seems like this, it's her adopted mom in this case, but like there's this kind of element of seeing through what the, you know, top layer is, through the superficial layer is, and kind of understanding something deeper about her child in that moment and how that plays out, the kind of patience of it, I found kind of touching in that moment. I think the movie ends pretty powerfully. I wasn't destroyed like I was at the end of 1001, but I was rather moved by the end of this film. It is a quiet kind of moment that we leave the character of Freddie at this point in her journey. But I thought the specifics of that were rather lovely. I just watched this yesterday, so I don't know as far as the lingering question exactly how that will play out for me. But I'm really glad to have watched this. I think it was worthwhile to check out after kind of being on the list, you know, the quote unquote list, not an official list, but the mental list. It wasn't actually on a letterbox list. That, for all my letterboxed activity, Jericho, I don't make lists of movies I plan to see. I just keep them in my brain. I just have them floating around and try to remember them.
Do you use the watch list option? I don't use that, but I know other people do.
I kind of do. Like, every once in a while I'll add movies to the watch list, but I don't ever refer to that when I watch movies, so there's no real point for me to do that. It would be a great utility. I feel like I should, like, white, because there's some like random shit from like years ago that I'm never gonna watch that's on my watch list, but I, you know, press that button years ago, so I feel like I should wipe it and like start from scratch and actually use it, because it probably would help me out. But I don't use it well. But what I was saying, Return to Soul was on a list. It was on a list for me of something to check out, and I think it was worthwhile. I think it was worth remembering that one and keep bringing it back up. I'm glad to have watched it, and I really love this performance. I think this performance from Park Ji-min, even if the film, if it does kind of fade away more quickly, I think this performance is something that was really powerful, and it was exciting to see from her. I know this is her first film, and she's you know, kind of a visual artist. So will she have an acting career beyond this? I guess that remains to be seen. But based on just this, I'm a big fan. So Return to Soul, worth the trip, I would say, Jericho, worth the trip.
Yeah, and real quick, just to touch on something. Another interesting choice, I thought, was that you don't see any of her life in France.
Right.
That it's that's all kept to dialogue, and you really only, the only glimpse you get is she has one scene of FaceTime with her adopted mother.
Yeah.
And that's it. So you don't even really get, you just assume her life is great and everything over there, and she's got tons of friends, but you don't even know what her deal is, really.
Sure.
And the mother, the adopted mother, is kind of concerned, because it seems like Freddie just like jumps on planes and goes places and has no real plan. So I thought that was a smart choice to do that, to not like begin the film in France and then kind of transition. But so there's some smart choices here by the director too. It's not all just the performance, but I think that's what we're both going to be leaving the film with. Is, for me, it's just that. I mean, the performance is great, but it's the character. And I feel like the real life actor here probably had to have had some input into this, because it doesn't feel like, it feels, for me, it really feels like it is coming from a female perspective, something we don't normally see. So maybe this is like similar to the Baumbach Gerwig thing that I was referencing, is the Davy Chow and Park could be like, they could do this again, maybe.
Sure. Yeah, I'd be excited if they did. I think Return to Soul, it's available to rent now. I think it's worth it. I saw that Mubi was attached to this in some way. We're big Mubi heads around here, but it's not streaming on Mubi yet for some reason. But I would imagine it'll probably be on there at some point.
It does feel like a Mubi release.
It does feel like a movie release, which again, listener, that's a big positive in our book.
Yeah. So maybe we'll do a movie Monday where we release a movie-centered episode on a
Having
Monday.
A case of the movie Mondays.
Yeah.
All right, so that's going to do it for Return to Seoul. Let's get to our pairing film here, Micro Habitat. This one's written and directed by Jeon Go-woon. Excuse me. It stars Isom, Jae Hong An, and Jae Hyun Choi. The synopsis, Jericho, this is the whole synopsis on IMDb. Let me clear my throat here. Whiskey and cigarettes, the only ways of keeping her dignity in this city.
good.
That's all, yeah, I like that's it. All it gives us. I don't think I had ever heard of this before you brought it up, Jericho. And we were talking about, is there other, you know, woman-led, you know, South Korean or Seoul set specifically films that we could talk about, something that rose to the surface to pair with Return to Seoul. You found this one. It looks like this is a pretty well-respected film. I took a quick look at kind of reviews and things like that, and it seems like this is something that people liked. I do not remember this at all from 2017, but that's festivals. I think it might have been a 2018 film officially. I don't remember this at all from when it came out. Was this something that you had heard about before, or you just kind of found in doing some research with Return to Seoul as the starting point?
Oh, yeah, I heard about it when it came out, and the buzz on it was good, and I don't remember where I heard about it from, but it was something I'd wanted to see, but then I completely forgot about it at this point, so it did take me kind of searching around, doing some Googling, and it popped up. I was like, oh, yeah, that movie, and I guess it's this director, she's only made this one feature film,
right?
Apparently, so I think it was supposed to be like, this is the emerging new voice, and then she hasn't done anything else. I think she's done some shorts and some collaborations since then, but hasn't kind of turned into a bigger career for her. But yeah, definitely was something that had been on my radar. And maybe if I had the Letterboxd watch list, if I used that, maybe I would have been an easier route. But it seemed to just from the outset fit because of the character. But knowing nothing else about where the story goes, because there's a lot of great like South Korean films that we could have chosen. We could have just went anything South Korean and done
sure.
they do make really great thrillers and psychodramas and stuff over there. But I don't know. This one kind of stood out as a possible like better pairing film with Return to Seoul.
Well, and I think that this is a great pairing. I think our lead character in this, Miso, has a similar kind of searching that she's doing, searching for her place. And maybe it's a less, you know, large overreaching type of search that she's on. She's literally looking for a place to stay. You know, she's looking for a roof over her head. And the setup that we have here, to put a little bit more color on it than that IMDb synopsis, we start with Miso, who has a pretty humble life. We have lots of scenes of her doing her budget in a little notebook and keeping her cash in a little cash register. And something very important to her that the synopsis does mention is getting her whiskey and cigarettes. She likes to have a drink. She likes to smoke pretty regularly. It's very important to her. And as the new year kicks off, tax implications or something going on, but the price of cigarettes is going up. The rent is going up a little bit. And so Miso makes the decision of, hey, this budget's not quite working out. She's a housekeeper, so there's also lots of scenes of her meticulously cleaning apartments and houses that are much nicer than where she lives. And she makes the decision to leave her apartment, to tell her landlord she's done after years in that place. She's going to pack all her things up into one suitcase and one bag and hit the road. And then from there, she meets different former bandmates. We find out that she used to be in a band, and we have these kind of like setups or little title cards letting us know the next person that she's going to visit is the drummer or the keyboardist or whomever. And she interacts with them, tries to basically couch surf and find a place to stay, at least temporarily. So, but with the purpose of finding something cheap or free so that she can keep her whiskey and cigarettes budget running smoothly. Some of those interactions are a little humorous. Some of them are a little cheeky. Some of them are sad. And she kind of, we learn a little bit more about the character along the way, but we mostly just, you know, what stuck out to me is just how she interacts with each of these people in kind of different ways. It's funny you brought up Greta Gerwig a couple of times on the last film, because this movie reminds me of Frances Ha, Greta Gerwig vehicle in kind of searching for a place to stay. This isn't as humorous as that, but I found a similar kind of like trying to find a place as a young woman in the city, somewhat similar. So that's something that came to mind while watching Microhabitat. And I love the tone of this. Like I said, at times it is a little bit playful. I think there is a lightness to it in moments. It doesn't always feel like I don't feel like you're trudging through this story like it's meant to be like the weight of the world. You kind of feel like Miso is a very simple character with simple desires, and she's just trying to find the way to live that out, at least in the first half or so of the story. And so I feel like it's kind of light on its feet at times. I also like, this is the only film that this director has made, as Jericho mentioned. I really like the confidence in some of the choices there as well. Like, I love an early shot that's kind of simple, but a lovely choice where Miso goes to answer the door when her landlord is there and the camera stays fixed, and we see a cockroach walk up and down the wall in the background of the shot as it remains there, and she walks off frame. Little choices like that I really liked as well. And as she, you know, we get, you know, she goes from house to house, and things kind of escalate to a certain degree. I also found this quite moving. I don't know. There's a lot that's kind of, you know, not shouted from rooftops or whatever, kind of like we were talking about the last film. It's a lot of relying on this character, this performance of this character to kind of tell us what her emotional journey is through a lot of this. I mean, I don't know, even something as simple as her reliance on whiskey and cigarettes, like, is that just the vestiges of her formal life, right? Is that her maintaining rock star, quote unquote, status? She's got to have her hard alcohol and her cigarettes. Like, that's an important identifying feature of her that she's not willing to let go, even though her life doesn't look anything like that. And she's been humbled and changed in certain ways over time. I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of smart, really subtle decisions. And honestly, Jericho, I loved this. I was really taken by this performance and the overall feeling that this movie captured over the course of it. I think this is a real find. You said you heard about this at the time. I'm really glad that this came up for you in review, because we did the Letterboxd look-see a little bit ago. I'm putting this up there as some of my favorite things I've seen this year. I really, really loved Microhabitat. I was a fan right from the jump, and this movie really hooked me. Like, I can't even fully explain it, to be honest, but like something about just capturing all these little moments, even in the beginning of the film, like, I don't know, like there's things that even seem like cutesier, like her spilling the rice out of the bag in like one of the early scenes in the movie. Like, it felt like something that could be like bouncier and jokier, but just, I don't know, threaded the needle for me in being like lightly humorous, but also giving you like little moments for character work throughout. Her journey and her arc in this movie really spoke to me. So this I liked even more than Return to Seoul. I was a huge fan of Microhabitat and very thankful that you put this on my radar. I absolutely loved it. I'll be revisiting this. I'll be trying to show this to people. I was really, really taken by Microhabitat.
Well, you're welcome, Christian. That's what I do. And it's funny because, you know, we're lockstep here. I mean, this, of the two films we're covering, this is the one that stuck with me.
Yeah, big time.
You know, they both center on aimless young women navigating their lives. They both take place mostly in Seoul, Korea, and both are largely about identity and what makes life worth living. But I think this one, and this is a debut, is able to juggle multiple tones, which is something that you touched on. There's like a wistfulness here, but there's also sadness. There's humor, and there's also, at times, quirkiness.
Yeah.
But then there's poignancy, and there's, you know, realism. So it's a really delicate line that Go Woon threads here. And basically, this character, Miso, who's in her early 30s, is kind of like semi-homeless for most of the movie. And those two major loves in her life that's in the synopsis and that you reference are cigarettes and whiskey, which are two vices that I think remind her of her past when she was playing in that band with her friends. It's a way of her connecting to, you know, the person she was, and she's trying to figure out who she's supposed to be now. All these friends that she visits have seemingly moved on with their lives. But what, you know, the great thing about this movie is Miso and us as the audience come to find out that they're just as aimless and just as like kind of depressed and lonely as she is. That scene you mentioned of her walking home from work with a bag of rice slowly seeping out of a trash bag is kind of like the perfect encapsulation of this character and what she's going through. She also wears multiple layers of clothes because she can't afford to heat her tiny apartment, which complicates her relationship with her boyfriend because their attempts at intimacy are hampered by how cold the apartment is. And I think that relationship is really well handled, too. I mean, there's the relationship he has with her boyfriend, which is kind of she covered throughout the film, going back and forth between those two. But this odyssey that Miso takes of semi-homelessness, where she's essentially spending time staying with these various ghosts of her past. And what happens is that as she infiltrates the lives of these people, whom she assumes are doing really well, being adjusted, domesticated, you know, content, making money, whatever, only to find out that they're aimless, just like she is. And the beauty of the movie is how our perception of Miso gradually changes and shifts. In many ways, I mean, she is taking advantage of other people's generosity, but we do also sense a genuine willingness on her part to alleviate the pain and the isolation of the people she interacts with. And so the theme seems to be that nonconformity or following one's unorthodox path through life is just as much of an option as following the social norms and doing what you're supposed to do. The friends she stays with are all prisoners of their mortgages, of their children, of their spouses, of their future goals. And Miso's compassion and empathy towards them makes many of them react with anger, kind of exposes their weaknesses and their self-loathing and the fact that they can't really deal with their own lives, and this person's coming in and kind of exposing that. But another question is Miso content? Is she happy? Is the way she chooses to live her life better than these others? Not really. I don't think so. I think the great thing about this film, Microhabitat, is how it patiently, lovingly, and humorously reveals that all of us no matter what our choices are in life, we're all in some ways lost and flailing, just trying to figure it out, just trying to survive. We are all of us are existing inside our own microhabitats, but the importance of South Korea, I think, will not be lost on people that are from that country, because it's a place that's very regimented and built upon conformity. So Miso seems to live in the past, even as aging pushes forward. And there's the great metaphor of her graying hair that she has to, you know, take these supplements or drugs to like stop the premature aging, premature graying of her hair. But the movie never judges Miso, but I don't think it makes her into a complete angelic figure who's like a Forrest Gumpian kind of like passing Absolutely. Through these people's lives and changing them. It's not quite like that. But similar to Return to Seoul, this film rests primarily on its central performance, even though you did point out a lot of smart choices from the writer-director, which I agree with. And I think the actor, Lee So-young, who's also known as Isom, gives this character a quiet dignity, but also moments of warmth and humor. I kind of fell in love with this character. I mean, like, Absolutely. Freddie, I was fascinated by. Freddie, I was intrigued by. Miso, I love. You know, I just love this character. And that's a large part because of Isom's the performance, but also the minimalistic direction and this very spare, haunting cinematography also goes a long way in immersing us in this character's inner and outer life. I just think it's a beautiful film and kind of sad that the director hasn't done anything else. I mean, I really want to see what she does next. You know,
it's more than sad. I think it's, I mean, I have no idea what her artistic pursuits have been since 2017, but I find it tragic. This is such a huge burst from a new voice. Like it's so confident and assured, and there's so many great decisions. And again, like, you know, I'm repeating a little bit from the last review, but seemingly the collaboration between her and the central performer, it just seems like such a wonderful relationship that we get to see the kind of final product of in the movie that I'm angry. It's tragic that she hasn't gotten another project made since then. I hope that if she has inspiration that that happens at some point, because this is an incredible debut. Absolutely.
Yeah, and I'm hoping it's just because she's taking her time, she's working on other things, and it's not having to do with the situation in South Korea or, you know, God forbid, some sort of sexism or inability to get this film made due to the patriarchy, you know, just being a woman and being a Korean woman. Maybe she's tried, who knows? But the fact of the matter is, we still have this one thing that she's made, and it's beautiful, and it's something that is widely available. So, I mean, I'm recommending both of these films today, but I'm really going to push. I'd rather push people towards this, because I feel like this is definitely a diamond in the rough kind of situation, something that needs to be uncovered and celebrated by more people, more cinema lovers.
Agree entirely. In South Korea, they have two major film awards organizations, the Blue Dragon Film Awards and the Grand Bell Awards. Grand Bell is often referred to as the South Korean Academy Awards. And Jeon Go-woon won Best New Director at both awards ceremonies. So it doesn't seem like something that went unnoticed in South Korea at a minimum. So I hope that she's built a name for herself that can do more. I mean, there's so much that's specific about this character, and I agree with you. My affinity for this character is what is a big reason why this works so much for me. But if you do take a step back and you think of this, I don't think it's unfair to think of this as a movie about poverty, or at least showcasing poverty. Mm-hmm. And I don't know the specific, you know, context for Seoul or South Korea, of course, but I mean, this is a woman who you know, is trying to support herself. She has meager means, but she doesn't want a lot, right? She has a very small apartment and she's just trying to feed herself and have a couple of simple pleasures in a drink and being able to smoke regularly. And she can't afford to do that. And she is unhoused for most of the film because of that. And, you know, there's a lot we don't know of this character or this overall story. What happened with the band? Did it disband because of any type of, you know, friction or vices, or were they just not successful enough? Did people just, you know, kind of quote unquote mature and like move out from it? We don't know all those specifics, but I mean, Miso not having a place, I mean, I think you can also kind of say like, you know, she's an artist who just doesn't have a place that she can comfortably exist. She no longer can use art as a way to support her life. So she is kind of forced into this more humbling position. And even that can't kind of satisfy her or keep her going in the simple life that she's set up for her. And I think she is a very sweet and simple character. And I don't mean that in any kind of backhanded way. And she just struggles to find a place. And that's kind of the quiet tragedy of this movie, is she doesn't really have a comfortable place that she can settle in with her desires of how she wants to live her life, the decisions that she wants to make. There isn't really a comfortable home for her. But the way that this movie doesn't try and make her a saint, you know, like we've seen like much cheesier movies, or at least the trailers for cheesier movies, right? Of like finding someone on the streets when they're like the Samuel Jackson movie or something, where he's like homeless and then becomes like he's in Carnegie Hall or something. I don't know. I just feel like there's so many like cheesy stories of like finding geniuses or beautiful people that just feel like really hollow, right?
I think that's Jamie Foxx. I think the Soloist with Robert Downey Jr., I think that's what you're describing. There is another movie where Samuel Jackson is a homeless guy, but that's the Casey Lemons movie called The Caveman's Valentine, and that's something completely different. But there is a lot of depictions of homelessness on screen that just are completely false and hacky. And what I'm agreeing with you, but also we do, in America, it's a completely different mindset we have towards homelessness. I mean, I'm thinking that this is even more of a, you know, societally is so looked down upon over there, I'm assuming. And that's kind of the vibe I got from all the people that she comes into contact with, is like, this is really against social norms to be doing this, you know, to be kind of hopping around in this way. It's just, it's seen as, I mean, it's seen that way here too, but we're just generally more used to it, I think. Especially people that are, you know, in their 20s or early 30s. I mean, it's kind of a rite of passage we all go through, right? Living in our cars, staying with people on couches. I mean, I've done that. So,
yeah.
But in South Korea, I'm not sure that that's as normative. So I think there's some commentary there. I'm obviously just speculating, but some commentary from the director on societally how homelessness is viewed, and a heartbreaking but kind of beautiful final shot too.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And that's what, there are those little moments that I feel like open it up to be more than just Miso's story, even though I think that's absolutely paramount. That's the most important element of the story. But I think there are glimpses of this maybe having like wider reach and extending beyond just this one character at spots. And I don't know, I feel like it'd be an easy trap to craft a story, to make a film about a character like Miso, and there be even a sense or a hint of condescending to that character, you know, treating her and her situation in some kind of way that feels a little off or a little gross. And I just don't think that Go Woon does that at all. I just feel like there's a lot of respect for this character, a lot of admiration for this character without lionizing her. And that's, again, that's a really delicate balance to strike. But I think from performer and director, it's done really well. And there's just, I don't know, there's so many little things in this movie, again, not to pit them against each other, but there's like things that I'm going to remember from this movie that aren't even that substantive. But like when she goes, I think it's maybe the first person she goes and visits, and they sit in that weird like tunnel chair, and she like pulls out an IV as they're having like an allegedly casual conversation. Things like that are just so striking and such like that really stick with me, even if it's not the most important aspect of the movie. There's little moments that that really shine without putting a spotlight on them. So I don't know, for so many reasons, I think Microhabitat's an easy recommendation.
Yeah, and we probably might be the only podcast talking about this movie, so
could be.
Hats off to us. But in any case, Christian, this was fun. This was good.
Yeah, Soul Sisters was a good theme. I'm very happy to have talked about both of these films. So, yeah, we can pat ourselves on the back for this one. We've talked about a couple of great South Korean films. Let's go. Let's do it. But that's going to do it, I think, for episode 211. If anyone checked either of these out or have some other Soul Sisters they want to put on our map, of course, reach out to us. TheThirdActPodcast@gmail.com. We're on Facebook and Twitter as well. Sometimes, not too much. Email is a great way to reach us, though. TheThirdActPodcast@gmail.com. That's going to do it. Jericho, we've been hopping around to so many different themes and ideas and films. Should we put anything else out there? I mean, he said we're not going to promise the Air Jair episode anymore. Maybe that's what's next. Maybe not. Who knows?
I feel like we might be approaching oversaturation mode right now, where it's like we are just doing too much. And I'm feeling we might be starting to lose what little audience we had. Like, why are like two or three episodes coming out in the same week? I can't keep up and unsubscribe, you know? We've totally turned and shifted into this. And not sure how long this will last, because it very well could be like a month until we do another episode. And then all of a sudden we're doing 2 to 3 episodes a week. But that's just kind of how we're rolling over here. So I think it's best,
yeah,
to just let it be for now and to see what comes out. I mean, the Air Jair episode, it will happen. But let's not stir the pot too much. I mean, let's just... Let's you know, at least let the ones that we've done recently kind of percolate and sit out there until we just move on to the next thing.
That's all fair. Yeah. And I said towards the beginning, is anyone listening? Is anyone actually on the journey through all these random turns we're taking? I think Myra is. I don't know about anybody else. So we have an audience of at least one, I'm confident in. But if anyone else is on board, we are not, we're lousy with ideas, Jericho. We have so many more ideas. We have so many ideas. Maybe this should be an off mic thing, but I feel like we should do something with all the ideas we have. We have like a wheel that we spin or something to decide what our next episode is, because we like jotted down a list like a couple weeks ago of like 6 ideas for episodes, and we've done all of those now. And now we have like another 6 or so ideas of things on top of Air Jair that are floating around of possible episode themes and movies and things like that. So I don't know. I feel like we could gamify or eventize this weird creative streak that we're on right now.
Yeah, you can do it on air where we have some kind of theme music and a wheel sound effect as we kind of. But that's also presupposing that anyone cares about any of this, and that we're just kind of talking into the void and we're just wasting people's precious time. But if you do have any ideas, I mean, we're pretty much almost. And this is rare for me because I'm usually very particular about things that I watch. But I feel like at this point, I'm watching Meteor Man. I'm probably going to watch the Super Mario Brothers movie. I mean, it's just, it doesn't matter anymore. Like, I'm pretty willing and open for anything. So I think we have a good mix, though, of kind of serious cinema literate films and just, mainstream pop stuff. I think we've done a good job of kind of going back and forth and sort of having fun with that. But if you have any listeners, if you have any more ideas for us, what's in the zeitgeist? What are people talking about? And even what aren't people talking about and they need to be talking about? People aren't talking about microhabitat. They should be. So what are we missing? Send us an email. Hit us up on social media. Christian gave you those, gave you the ways to do that. I mean, we are definitely sponges at this point.
It's great. I love all this introspection and, you know, calls to the audience we're doing right now. No one's going to listen to this episode, even in episodes
you say that. You say that, but then we get Workmeister Harmony's emails.
That's true. That's
true. I mean, every once in a while we get some feedback. I think people are listening. It's just, it's hard to get, unless we really piss somebody off and do something to, God forbid, get canceled. I don't think, most people don't write in if they're enjoying something. So I'm just going to believe that people are enjoying what we're doing. And that's the reason they're not writing in, because unless... You know, it's like Yelp or whatever. You know, you're less likely to write a positive review than a scathing one. So we haven't got many scathing reviews, so that's good, right?
That's true. And we have had, not in the last like couple of weeks or so, but we have had some really lovely emails and letters, people writing in.
Sure, yeah.
And we don't want to guilt anyone of like, hey, you have to email us and tell us how much you love us. We'll keep going. And hopefully, even though we're ubiquitous these days, we are doing these breezier 60-minute episodes, at least, Jerrica. We're not going to yammer on for 3 hours about microhabitat, even though we might be able to do that. But we're being a little bit more succinct, right? We're encapsulating these reviews in a way that hopefully is listenable. All right, enough soul searching. See what I did there?
Yeah, I did. You didn't have to call attention to stuff. I got it.
All right, let's get out of here. Listeners, thanks so much for being here. And remember that the greatest act of all is the third act of the rest of our lives. Make the best of it and have a good night.